Good morning, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to Family Life. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent Mirage Speaks, your host, Salima Muhammad, and Dr. Nadia Muhammad. Dr. Nadia Muhammad is doing community projects, however, she will join us in the near future. The Allah and Khmana Rahim in the name of Allah, the most gracious and most merciful. I greet the listening audience in the peace of Assalamu Alaikum. The title of our show, Family Life Today's topic is Fostering Therapeutic Children. According to the most recent federal data, there are currently more than 400,000 children in foster care in the United States. They range in the age from infants to 21 years old in some states. Today, our guest, Malika Waleed, is a loving mother of 5 wonderful children, the mother of 4 adult children and 1 teenager. Malika has been a therapeutic foster parent since 1999, giving the attention and care to foster children along with her children. Malika is in her 21st year of providing therapeutic care of fostering. Sister Malika is the recipient of the Open Door Wooden Plaque Award in 2006. Malika's door was always open to children despite their circumstances. Her second award was in 2014, and as a foster parent, she was described as a chameleon, a foster parent of many colors, going above and beyond the cause. Malika, if you can elaborate a little more on what this award meant, and welcome to the show.
Salaamu Alaikum, sister. How are you doing today?
Excellent.
Well, you know, with therapeutic fostering, as I would like to say in my home, a therapeutic fostering setting, having the ways to empower children to be their best person, taking them to the doctor, to the dentist, being there to nurture them when they're sick, helping them with schoolwork, going to conferences. But most of all, giving them the love and the stable environment in which they all need. And, you know, just being there for them 100%. And that really makes a difference.
Thank you. Explain the detail of what therapeutic, I want you to concentrate on the therapeutic portion of foster care so the listening audience know the extent of conditions and diagnoses that you're containing and dealing with these children?
Well, I would truly, truly, truly say that it takes a lot of faith, a lot of strength to deal with the different personalities coming into your home. All of them are unique in their own individual way. You have some that, you know, may be bipolar. I have had some that are schizophrenic, diagnosed with psychotic behaviors, severe bedwetters, challenged day-to-day dealing with all the different trials and tribulations of what they have already been through as children. And, you know, a lot of children are coming through the system where the parents just can no longer take care of them. Most of them are actually children who have came from home of drug abuse. And the parents, you know, have no other way of teaching them how to survive except to, you know, to put themselves into a drug situation when that entails the children going into the system. But that being said, a lot of different personalities to deal with, And with me and my children, you know, we do the best we can as far as being loving and caring, which, you know, made it easier and teaching them how to be kind, you know, and gentle and just patient with, you know, with me dealing with the kids and in general just dealing with that overall. And that kind of keeps the home balanced as best as I can do.
Give us an example of some of those personalities and what those children did and what made that challenging for you as a foster parent and what made it challenging for your children. So explain to the listening audience the type of behaviors you would get over the 20 years.
Well, without saying names, and I have had many, many, many children, because like you said before, I received the Open the Door Award, which was surprising to me, dealing with the challenges, because I didn't even know that I was the only foster parent at that time that never turned a kid down. I just assumed that's what everyone does. And I would say with all the different personalities, I had one kid years ago. He's coming out of Rome, Georgia. And his situation was where his grandparents was keeping him due to, you know, his mother being on drugs. And, you know, most grandparents, you know, they already living their lives, already lived it. She was doing the best she can, but, you know, he was destructive with the home, you know, fighting her, kicking her, biting her, you know, unless he had his way. So she put him in a system. You know, he came to my home. I had him for a year. But when I first got him, he could not read at all. He was 7 years of age, and he didn't know how to read. So I had some books some years ago from my kids being in kindergarten and so on. So I taught him how to read. So it took about, I would say, 6 months. But it wasn't easy. You know, it was hard. You know, he didn't want to read. He didn't want to learn. But, you know, at the end when he left, you know, he cried because, you know, he loved me. And I told him I loved him, and I told him to be good to his grandparents. So that was one that I had. I had another one that he was a severe bedwetter. And I went online and bought some of the mattress pads. A lot of times they buy, you know, for hospitals and stuff, you know, so it would be easy for him and taught him how to just find a system for himself. And then I woke up like, I set my clock to wake up between 3 and 4 in the morning so he would get up, just like if he was potty training a child. And, you know, just having to go through these processes all over again, even with older children. And I even had an adult child that she was 17. She was a severe bedwetter. She was still wetting the bed at 17. And I wasn't able to help her, you know. She just chose not to have to go through it. Like she said, she didn't like getting up out of the bed. So I just said, okay, well, that was a challenge. So, you know, I had to eventually let her go because it was just too much for my home, you know, and everything that it put out in the home, it pretty much just spread all over the house because, you know, she didn't want to keep herself hygiene together. And I had one. He was 14-year-old man. I couldn't keep him long, but I really, you know, thought that I could help him change. But come to find out, his mother did severe drug abuse with herself, which when I spoke with her, she did every drug possible, you know, to abort him. But she said, okay, that wasn't, you know, God's will, so she ended up having him. And he turned out to be one of those kids where he had psychotic behaviors. He was schizophrenic, paranoid schizophrenic. He was, so with all those together, combined, when he came into the home the first day, he asked me, could he have a key to my house? And I told him, I just kind of chuckled and said, oh, well, you know, we don't give out keys. And anyway, so, but yeah, he was a challenge. I didn't have him for a long period because he wanted to fight everybody. Every day it was something, you know, that he wanted to do. He wanted to fight. He had a highly extreme, severe behavior when it came to disrupting the home. Even in school, he loved fighting. was always explaining how, you know, when he came home from school that he had a great day. And I said, well, that's great. His great day was actually fighting. You know, he enjoyed fighting. And I felt like that was very bizarre, and I tried to get him to understand that wasn't good. But to make a long story short, on the end, I had to let him go. So over the years, those are the type of children that I have dealt with and different personalities. And I have had, you know, sweet children, children, they had challenges, but they weren't as severe, so therefore I kept them longer periods of time. I have one that I had, his name is Lamonte. He still comes around. He still called me Mom. I had him for 8 years. And he came to my home in 2008. And I had him, and he still comes around, and he, you know, takes me out for Mother's Day and, you know, and all of that. And then I had one, her name was Brittany. I had her for 4 years. So I had most kids for at least a year, the ones who wasn't as severe, but they still had a lot of behaviors. And within that those years, sometimes it leveled off and balanced for a few months, and then they'd get back, you know, on that high horse of doing things wrong, and then they'd, you know, get back balanced again. So that was a challenge, but I felt like since they kind of understood what I was trying to do for them and they balanced themselves most of the time, I just decided to just, you know, let them, you know, go through the independent living program and, you know, age out of my home, which is the age of 21.
Let's talk about the psychotic one again. I want the listening audience to really capture what you physically go through. Now, Sister Malika is a short sister. Let me just describe this first. She's a short sister. But she has that firm, tough love. So let me explain to the audience that in this particular one, died and murder ideation.
Yes, correct.
And sometime they would come after you. Tell us, Malika, what you would do when they would come after you.
Well, this particular one that I just mentioned that was in my home for a short period of time. Now, when I say that Allah is great, and I have to say this, out of my 20 years, I never had anyone to actually, like, directly try to hurt me in a bad way, but they would say things that they would want to do to hurt me or what they thought of wanting to do to hurt me. And then they would back up and say, well, you know, I wanted to, you know, I thought about it, and I said, you know what, I'm going to flatten your tires. But then I realized if I flatten your tires and you don't die, then I was like, oh, my goodness. But I would keep a straight, firm face, you know, like, oh, okay, okay. Because you have to be there. I mean, you really have to think where they're coming from and then realize, okay, most of these children are really disturbed in a way. So I just played the game by saying, oh, okay, so you really wanted to hurt Ms. Malika, huh? I'm talking in third person to him. And he said, yeah, but then I realized if you didn't die, oh, my God, you're going to be, like, real upset, and I was afraid of what you might say and do. And I said, well, you know, most of all, I said, do you really like it here? And I always ask every single kid that I have had at least for 2 months, when they start doing more and more things, I would ask them all the time, do you like it here? And they would all tell me, oh, I love it here, you know. I think I may have had only one out of all those years, one or two that said, you know, they was ready to leave or whatever. But mostly every kid I had liked it here because kids want discipline. They want, when I say discipline, I'm not talking about in terms of where the system teaches that you can't touch them. They don't want you to raise your voice at them. Well, okay, let's be realistic here. When you're dealing with kids who have came from destructive homes, whether it be abuse, true enough, you don't want to abuse them and put them in that same setting. But at the same time, you have to protect yourself and your children in your home, but teach them in a way where, okay, you got to teach them just like we was taught in the old school days. Okay, you, it's not that you feared your parents, but yeah, let's be honest, yeah, you did fear your parents, okay? But you feared them, okay, so you feared them to the point that you wanted to give them the right amount of respect in order to stay in their home until you reach the age of them saying, okay, it's time for you to leave the home, go off to college, so on and so forth. Well, I tried that with all the foster kids. But some foster kids, like I said, each kid is different. That young man, the reason why I let him go, he wanted to fight everybody in the house except for me. Now, I never understood that, why he never wanted to fight me. Matter of fact, I'm the smallest one besides my little, you know, my teenage son. And I remember him just going off on my husband, calling out his name, and, you know, telling him, come on, you know, let's do this, you know, let's do this, trying to fight him. And I got in between them. Now, take it now, I'm just a little 5'2". I'm just 5'2". So I got in between him, and I said, this ain't happening, okay? We're not going to do this. So I took him outside, my foster son, and I got him to understand. And that's what I said. I said, you know, do you like it here? And he said, yes, ma'am, like that. So if you like it here, what I need for you to do is just breathe. We're going to count to 10. We're going to breathe together. We're going to breathe this out, okay? And he said, yes, ma'am. I said, because I need for you to do the right thing, because otherwise I'm going to have to let you go. I said, because the only person you're going to be fighting up in this house is me. Okay? And he just laughed, and he thought it was funny. And most times, that's how I'm able to get most kids to relax and just let go, because I try to turn it into a, I would call it a sense of humor and just being straightforward, but I'm speaking my mind in a stern voice, but at the same time, I kind of turn it into a joke so they can still get it, but at the same time, letting them know Mr. Malika means business. So he joked about it. He laughed and, you know, got over that. But overall, he tried to fight everyone, and the reason why I had to let him go is because he tried to smother my 14-year-old son. And when I say that Allah is great, I was back in my room. I don't remember what I was doing, but I know not to stay back here in long periods of time, you know, probably, you know, using the restroom or something. And something in my heart told me to move. And what I mean by move is like I had to go up to the front, you know, to see, you know, just to check on everybody. I said, let me walk in and see what's going on. You know how you be thinking in your mind. And then when I went in there, I saw everybody moving real fast. I saw the young man jump up real fast, and I saw my son jump up with, like he was startled and tears running down his face as if he was terrified. And the minute I saw that, Karen, you automatically kick into that protect mode, but at the same time, you have to stay balanced, as I said before. When you're thinking and you're processing, saying, okay, I got to find out what's going on here before I snap. So I know I can't snap. So I said, okay, what's going on? So everybody's looking afraid. The young man looks, and he looks in the chair, trying to put fear into him. And I said, kid, don't look at him. Look at me. Look at me. I said, tell me what's going on. And his voice is shivering, and he's terrified. I said, just breathe it out, baby. Just breathe it out. Talk to me. He said he tried to smother me. He said, I told him I can't breathe. You know, he said, my voice has been muffled. I told him I can't breathe. I was trying to say I can't breathe. And he said, you can breathe. He kept saying, you can breathe. He was saying it like he thought it was funny. But had I not came up there, only Allah knows best if my son would be here today. So after that, I told the young man, you know, of course, what he was saying, you know, because he's going to try to protect himself. Somebody, you know, he was cussing and, you know, saying, you know, forget y'all. I don't have to, you know, take this boon and y'all, you know, don't believe what I want to say, you know, and you just believe in what your children say. And don't get me wrong, I hear that all the time. When children are doing wrong, they want to justify by saying you're going to believe your children first. Well, no, I did not teach my children that way. I taught my children to be truthful, to be good to people, to love people, but don't let people hurt you intentionally. And just don't be a fool for people. So I got him to understand, no, my children, they not like that. I said, no. I said, so what you're trying to get me to understand is that he's just making all this up with tears running down his face? And he's looking terrified? You're not looking terrified. You're looking fine. Say that you didn't try to hurt. Anyway, to make a long story short, I had to call the dispatch workers. You know, they have a protocol where you have to give them at least 14 to 30 days. And the way I roll, when it comes to someone trying to hurt anyone, whether it be another foster kid, I literally let DFACS know in my stipulation that's not happening. I told the lady she had one day, and she said, well, Ms. Wally, but you know this protocol. I said, listen. I said, I'm not trying to get on the news. Matter of fact, I asked her, does she have children? And she said, yes, ma'am. I said, you know, and I said, so then that's when I explained to her. Just pretend that you walked into a room and someone was trying to smother your child. But you got there just in time. What would you do? Would you give them 14 days? Would you give them 30 days? And she said, well, I understand. I said, no, you're not understanding. I just explained to you. I said, so therefore, you know that you wouldn't do it, so why do you expect me to do it? I said, so what I need for you to do is get him out of my home, and I'm giving you, I tell you what, I'd be nice. I give you 2 days. I give you the day that we're speaking of right now on the phone and tomorrow. Okay? And she said, yes, ma'am, I'm going to do what I can. I said, yes, I said, if you don't, I'm going to have to just drop him off at the police station or even drop him off at DFAC's office somewhere else because he's not going to be able to stay here. I'm not giving him another chance to try to hurt child or any other child who's in the home. I had another foster kid in the home at the time. He was 6 years of age. And I just told him it's just not feasible for me to keep him. And I think she got it because he was gone the next day. She called me that morning and told me that they had a transporter that came. That he'd be coming that afternoon when he gets out of school. And the minute I picked him up from school and brought him home, which he went to a behavior school. He went to alternative school, which is school for children, you know, who just having a lot of problems and that they're not able to stay in a regular school environment. So, yeah, he did go to those particular types of schools. So that shows right there he had a lot going on. So, yeah, he was gone that next day. And he just, even though he had done all he had done, he still thanked me. He said, Ms. Walid, I want to thank you for allowing me to be in your home and that I really wish I could stay. He said, I am so sorry for everything I've done. I really wish I could stay. And I said, I know, baby. I said, I understand. I said, but no. I said, you got to go, man. I said, you got a venture to take. You got a venture. I said, you know, you just do the right thing, you know, and just try to stay good. I said, just try to stay good. But, you know, a lot of the kids, you can tell them that, but it's really when they have dealt with a lot of drugs and their parents did drugs with them always through the 9 months or whatever they have done with these kids, they don't understand that some kids, you know, you just never know how they're going to turn out. And with him, I think the drugs made him dark.
So that's what he
was dealing with, and I was dealing with. And anyway, I had to let him go. And yeah, so that's pretty much what I deal with day to day basis with some of these kids.
Absolutely. Talk about some of the training certifications that you've received and the type of training that you received over the years working with these children.
Well, you have to take classes like self-detain it's called CPI. I don't remember the actual name of it. I just called it the CPI class. I'm just using my initial. But, yeah, that's a class where, you know, you go in there, we go in, and before the COVID hit, you know, we have to take that class once a year where everybody go in and you take turns with a partner. And, you know, you do the different defenses, you know, if the child was to come behind you and try to choke you, you know, how to get out of that position, different restraint positions because really they don't even want you to restrain a child. In other words, if you can help it, they don't even want you to touch the child, period. Now, that sounds strange, doesn't it? But that's, you know, certain things that they teach us. So, but then they teach you that if you can, if the child comes towards you from the back or from the front or whichever angle, how to position your legs, how to position your body so you won't fall and lose your balance. So that's the CPI class. We have we got to do first aid. We got to do that class that, you know, it teaches you how to, you know, to wrap your arm. And we got to do the CPR first aid, how to, you know, if you had a foster kid and they were to, you know, you take them swimming and they were to drown, you have to learn how to do CPR for children and for adults. I don't think, what other trainings do we have? Pretty much just, yeah, we have classes, too, sometimes dealing with the drug trafficking, you know, the trafficking of children and how to pay attention to children that you see that come into your home that may be a subject of that. And even if you out, if you were to see children who in that way, and or you can see it like you're in the store and you something looks strange to you, you know, to just dial 911 and tell them what you think may be going on. We had a class like that before. And, yeah, it's just in classes, we have classes that's dealing with how to be patient with children, you know, how to work with children with bipolar, how to work with children with schizophrenia. We have to take all these classes and how to recognize. And now, not saying that you can diagnose, because we can't say we diagnose because we're not doctors. But in other words, I had a young man in my home, and he had behaviors, because I had many kids with bipolar. So I noticed that I could see that he was exhibiting these behaviors. So, like, I called his grandmother, because, you know, he was able to talk with her, and I asked her, you know, not trying to be, you know, into a business, but I explained to her that I asked her the certain things he had done before in the past, and she explained to me, yes, he has. And I said, well, you know what? I said, you might want to check with his psychiatrist, because at the time he was still able to go home for business, and see, you know, that he may be bipolar. And I told her, I said, no, I'm not trying to diagnose him. But come to find out, he did exhibit behavior of that. And when she had him checked out, because she was able to still do that part, even though he was in the foster system, he was bipolar. His father was bipolar. His father's father was bipolar. Now, I mean, like I said, I'm not a doctor. But, you know, just taking that class, paying attention to all the children that I had over the years that was diagnosed and already had it in their description of being bipolar, you could see the pattern. And so, therefore, I was able to, you know, help him in that way, you know, and help his grandmother to understand him a little better. But, yeah, those are the classes, we, you know, we do a lot of.
Yes, ma'am. The TPI is the, for the listening audience, is the Crisis Prevention Institute, and the training that the foster parents specifically get are the crisis intervention training. And you gave an excellent description of the variations. And, you know, we have so much going on today, like you say, with children trafficking and, you know, adult trafficking, to notice these, you know, specific signs. That is such excellent, excellent, excellent training. As a mother, a mentor, a doctor, a teacher.
Yes.
Describe the mindset you've had to maintain to keep moving forward. A lot of states that he does not put a burden on his soul beyond that it can bear. That is what I'm sorry, number two. I got 286. Explain what that means to you.
Well, keep moving forward. I would say, to me, it's like life is as bearable as you can make it. Life is, to me, about just loving the people and caring for people and just giving out the best of yourself. It's like, I guess I'm trying to explain that, like you just saying, you know, a lot puts no more on earth than we can bear. It's true. It's really true, because some days I feel like, you know, because like I said, we're human. And some days I feel like, you know, I just have to have that break or that time to myself. And so, therefore, just in the last, I would say in the last four, maybe the last 4 years, I say it might not even be 4 years, I started sending, you know, some of my foster kids on respite. And what respite is where you take a break from the child and you send them to another foster parent, you know, and you go through the protocol, the program that I'm with, which is called Lower Heights Therapeutic Hospital Program. That is, you send the children, you call your consultant, and you ask them, okay, you know, I would like to take a, you know, a little weekend break or whatever, and you let them know like 2 weeks in advance that you want to, you know, do that. So I just started doing that, and because I felt half, I just wanted to be there for them, and, you know, just, you know, thinking that I could do all I can. But over the years, I realized, you know, you can't save everybody, but, you know, if you can just save one or two, that's great. So, yeah, I started doing rest. To me, that's my way of saying, okay, when you can't bear, when you can no longer bear it, and it's just too much and it's too overwhelming, you know, it's okay to take a break. And that's what I started doing. I started doing respite. I started sending the children when they just came overwhelming. Okay, I would do that. But I still never did that often. I always took them everywhere I went. If I went home for the holidays, you know, to visit my mom or wherever, you know, I would take them with me. And, you know, because I always wanted them to feel like they belong. But over the years, I just started taking a break. And my break is normally just a short break. I may go, you know, visit my mom for leave out on the Friday and come back on the Sunday. And, yeah, so that's what I would, how I would look at it, is trying to, you know, to keep myself balanced in order to be a good mentor, you know, and do what I need to do to be that teacher and keeping them balanced and learning, you know, to just be there for them.
Yes, ma'am. To the listening audience, thank you for tuning in. We are speaking with Malika Waleed, and we are speaking about the many variations of fostering therapeutic children. This show has been brought to you by New Africa Excellence, Mirage Speaks. Malika, as we move forward, and I want you to give a generic overview. Although this is a source of income, it really isn't that much. So to the listening audience, Malika truly does this out of the heart and soul of her being and trying to make a difference in society. So, Malika, if you could talk a little bit about that being a source of income, but it is not much.
No, it's not. Well, they think it is now. You know, they're trying to convince us every day. You know, hey, you know, y'all getting a lot. You know, we give a lot to you all to manage these children and to be there for them and to, you know, to take care of them. And I'm like, yeah, right, not. Anyway.
Let's use this as an example. We're going to say the children are not therapeutic per se. There aren't any specific diagnoses. How much does a parent get per child for, say, a non-therapeutic child?
Well, depends on, first of all, it depends on what state you live in.
Certainly.
And here in Georgia, you know, the prices vary. Because one thing I really have to share, I have to say this, because it's not even getting off topic, but it's really a true factor. For example, the young man I had that, you know, he's just like family, that I had for 8 years. When I had him, around his fifth year, okay, I was getting paid $50 a day. $50 a day. And some people may look at that like, oh, man, that's $1,500 a month. Wow. No. Think about it. Okay, you're getting $50 a day. Okay, but then you teach them, you know, to do what's right. You know, you teach them right from wrong. You take them to the doctor. You take them to the dentist, court, when they have to go to court. You know, if they have behavior in school, you go up to the school. You have conference. You do all these things just like you would for your own kids. But at the same time, you know, when the holidays come, they still want you to be there for them. You know, then you buy clothes for them. You know, if they want to do sports, you have to pay for the sports. But they say they reimburse you. Most of the time, from my understanding, they reimbursed me. I'll never forget it. It was $500. And I take it he was playing football. He did wrestling in the eighth grade. $50 a day. Like you said, the money they claim is for you and for you to provide for that child. Well, that's already gone because you don't spend $1,000 just for them to play football. Okay, then when you do that, you know, you have to make sure, you know, everybody's fed. You're doing everything you need to do for that child. But after 5 years, they came to me and they said, Ms. Waleed, you have done such a wonderful job. But the fact was, you know, said, you know, since you're doing so well, we're going to drop you down to $16 a day.
Wow. That's a
big
drop.
Yeah, $16 a day. So I would say in most cases, because I don't really check into it anymore because that was years ago, from my understanding, they have different base pay. Different base pay meaning if the child behavior is not severe, you would get paid $16 a day, even though they all have behaviors. So, and I would say 99% of them have behaviors. Whether they're mad because they didn't want to leave their parents or whatever the case may be. You know, they come into a new setting, so therefore they're going to come most of the time with some type of behavior. The base pay in most cases back in the day used to be $12 a day.
Oh,
and that was just, yes, that's a child coming out of regular DFAC. And what I mean by regular DFAC is mean like if the child is not in a therapeutic environment, they feel like, okay, a therapeutic child, they claim they pay you more. Said, okay, if he's therapeutic and you pay me $50 a day, and now that I don't got him where he's doing better in society, and now who was this, you know, who helped his child get this his way?
Yes,
who worked hard with his child? Who stayed up at night when this child was sick? Who did all this? And now you want to drop me down to $16 a day? I told her this is what we're going to do. Now, this is me. This is Miss Malika talking. I said, this is what we're going to do. I said, I need for you. I said, if you want to write this down, you can. I said, you go, you tell your caseworker or whoever's over you. I said, this ain't got nothing to do with you, sweetie. I said, you know, how old are you? She said, I'm 25. I said, okay, well, yes, sir, so you still learning. I said, you tell her that if they drop me down or try to drop me down $16 a day, I will help him pack his stuff and I will be giving him back to you all. How about that?
Yes, ma'am.
And they didn't bother me no more. They
yes,
left it at $16 a day. Because if they just like anyone else, if they can take what they take from you after you have did what you had to do, they're not going through no struggles. They're not going through nothing. But they want to take your money because it's a racket. So the way I look at it, you know, is if I'm going to be there to help a child, then it's not that you do it for money, but at the same time, you have some kids that know how the system works. And they'll tell you, I have kids come in and say, you know, well, if it wasn't for me, you wouldn't be getting paid. And I would tell the child, well, that's not really true. I said, because if it wasn't for me and they weren't paying me, you wouldn't be in my home. I said, so no one is going to keep children with severe behaviors for free. Things that are extreme. I know a foster parent, her home was burnt down. Yes, the whole home, completely.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And guess what happened? Did DFACs give her another home? No, they did not. They pretty much convinced them that, you know, when you come into this, what you get. That's why we do classes to teach you this and teach you that. So they pretty much threw it right back at her. So that's why I give tough love. Tough love, you know, I'm there for you. I love you. Give you what you need. But, yeah, you have to really be careful because things like that happen, and they pretty much throw it right back at the foster parent.
Yes, ma'am. And, you know, one of the things I thought was fascinating, and you're such a phenomenal cook. Listening audience, oh, my gosh, you need to have a food channel. Because she comes like, wow. And it tastes so delicious. The meal planning for these children, you know, is very intense. Can you talk about that for a few minutes, please?
Well, just like you would with your own family. You know, your child goes off in the morning to school, you know, because they get free lunch. Now, they get free lunch. But taking now, most kids, you know, don't want to always eat the lunch, which I tell them, you know, I'm sorry, but you need to eat the lunch, you need to eat the breakfast, you need to eat everything that they're giving you. I said, because when you come home, I'm going to do my part, you know, and that is like when school is in, you eat what you're supposed to eat, when you come home, I'm going to give you a snack. They prefer you to give them a snack, you know, and I give like, you know, I go out and I would have apples, I would do peanut butter crackers, you know, different snacks that they eat on. I try to stay away from sugar. I stopped buying juice years ago, but I found out that most kids, all they want to drink is juice. So I told them, if you want some juice, you need to drink the juice they give you at school. I said, because Ms. Malika's not buying any juice. So I stopped buying juice years ago, around, I would say, around 2004. I stopped buying juice. You know, only way you see juice in my house, it has to be a special occasion. But the milk turn is just like any other milk turn. On the weekends, you know, when they're home, I give, during the summer, you know, I get up, you know, they get breakfast, you know, then they get a nice lunch, and then I give them a nice dinner, and then I always give them a snack, you know, in between, sometime in between dinner, because it's general, you know, what time I'm fixing dinner, I may give them a snack. Now, you get some children come in, you know, want to have a snack before they go to bed. I told them, you know, that's not going to happen. I said, drink you a tall cup of water. I said, let it carry you through the night.
What I love and what I find fascinating about you, because you have shared this with me, is that when you take these children, whether physical, the annual, biannual, whatever the situation is, their physicians praise you for lowering cholesterol. You just really give them a healthy, balanced meal. When you're fixing meal, when you're preparing meals, do you have that in mind?
Oh, yeah, I try to do the best I can with that. What I normally do, when kids come to my home, I normally ask, and I try to work real hard on doing that, is ask every kid what they like to eat. And, you know, of course, they think, you know, they're going to trick me, right, by saying, oh, I like McDonald's, and I like Burger King, and I like, and I said, well, no, I'm not talking about that type of food. I said, I understand. I said, well, no, I'm talking about food at home. What type of food did you eat when you was at, you know, your other foster home, or what type of foods you like that are healthy foods? And most kids can't name a lot of healthy foods because they don't want those type of foods. So they'll name, oh, I like hot dogs and fries. And don't get me wrong, I do that every once in a while. But, like, one little boy I had, the one I told you I had for a year, and he went back to his grandparents, when he came to my home, I remember fixing some, I think it was turnip greens and, you know, that type of food. You know, I had turnip greens and stuff like that. And he told me, oh, I don't eat that type of food. And I told him, I said, well, just, at least try it. I said, you won't know unless you try it. So I gave him like a tablespoonful of it. And he said, oh, that's good. I said, so you like it? He said, yeah. So after that, he liked, you know, he liked greens. But it has a lot to do with how you cook it. So I try to cook food, you know, and not everybody can afford to do that. But, you know, I try to, you know, cook with, you know, olive oil and coconut oil, you know, stuff to give the food an extra flavor. And, you know, garlic and onions, you know, I try to put onions in everything. And I do that even with children that are sick. And children are sick, you know, I try to do everything old-fashioned. You know, whereas I tell them, okay, Ms. Malika is old school. I said, so therefore I'm going to get you some soup. If they catch a cold, I say, okay, Ms. Malika got some special soup. And they always like the soup. You know, I chop up some fresh garlic and chop up a lot of onions and, you know, put all types of, a little bit of kale chopped up, a little bit of spinach and stuff like that. Put that in there with some noodles and use some broth, you know, some chicken broth or something, and just give it that extra flavor, a little bit of sea salt and a little spice, you know, a little cayenne pepper, just a teeny bit, you know, just to get that inflammation out of the body, and they love it. And really, you know, it helps, you know. And so I try to do eucalyptus tea. You know, I try to keep all that type of stuff, try to do the old remedies, because I know I had one kid, he said he did not like, you know, that, you know, his grandma always gave him cough medicine when he got sick. And I said, well, baby, I can't give you cough medicine. He said, why not? I said, because I don't bite. And, you know, so he got mad and said, you know, well, I want some cough medicine. I said, well, let me call to see if that's something that I have to do. And that was me being sarcastic.
I'm not,
yeah, okay. It was not happening. Yeah, but I did go, I did do the protocol. I called and told them the way I do it. And then they said, Ms. Wally, you know, do what you know is best. They said, it's not like you're giving them something that's going to harm them. Because I let them know what I was doing. So I made him some fresh peppermint tea. I gave him a few drops of peppermint. I, you know, boiled the water on the stove. I put a little lemon in it. and some honey. And by the time I told him to put his head over it with his hands wrapped around it and inhale it as much as he can until, you know, till it starts to cool off. After that, it opened up his sinuses. And he drank that tea, and he wanted a whole nother cup.
Isn't that beautiful? And it was good for him.
Yes, it was for him.
Wonderful. Well, Lisa, you have a special story to share with us about a particular foster child that was very challenging. Could you share that with us?
Oh, yes, I remember. His name was Deontay. And I got him in the beginning part. I had him for a year. It was like a split. I had him, and then he left, and then he came back. And what it is, the man wanted to, the family, he was a friend of the family member that adopted his brother. But he tried to bring Deontay in, and Deontay pretty much just did a whole lot of, I would say, a lot of evil. And so the man said, okay, I can't do this. So the man put him back in the lower height system. And, of course, they came to me because they said, well, Ms. Wally, nobody else want to take him. You're the only one who knows how to work with him. Because I had him for 5 months at the beginning. And then, like I said, the man went, he went to the man's home, the man's going to adopt him. But anyway, that didn't happen. So I said, oh, my God. I said, oh, are you sure? They said, Ms. Wally, you're the only one who can work with him. I said, I'll do the best I can. So anyway, I took him back. To make a long story short, he was with me a total of a year. Maybe a year and 2 months or something. So that was around 2003, a little bit earlier. Deontay used to do all sorts of stuff. He used to curse out the teachers. One time he hawked at the teacher and just spit him. He drank some water from the faucet. She was telling him it was time to go back in class, and he just hawked everything he can hawk out of his body onto this teacher's head. Anyway, they had to send the teacher's home, you know, this particular teacher home, because she was just so disturbed by what he had done. Anyway, he called me. He begged him not to call me. And, you know, because like I said, you know, I gave tough love, and I, you know, they had me come up there. I had to pick him up. And, yeah, he just, you know, he used to curse at the teacher. He used to throw chairs. He had to do community service one time at the cab sanitation place, because he got caught with some weed. And when that happened, he's supposed to have been doing a week now. Listen to this, a week. Within that week, he couldn't even last a week. The man called me and my husband and said, look, we can't keep this young man. He said, this boy is terrible. He said, he's up here stealing grown men's lunch. Then he tried to fight this man, 6'4". He said, you know, we got a man here, he's 6'4". This boy is trying to fight this man after he done sold this man's lunch. And I said, oh, my God. I said, well, okay. He said, but I would like to have a story for you before you leave. And I said, yes, yes, sir. He said, you know, and at the time, Deontay was back in the car. He said, first of all, he can't come back. He's not going to be able to complete his community service here. He said, you know, I'm explaining something to you. He said, but his behavior and the things he was doing here, trying to fight everybody and stealing their lunches, he said, he's not going to last. He's going to mess around and get killed. He said, but I'm hoping you can help him. He said, but the way he's going, he said, I don't know. So I said, I understand, sir. I said, you know, but I appreciate everything. So like I said, Deontay did all these things. You know, he used to try to fight everybody, but in the end, the reason why I had to let him go after around, like I said, about a year to 2 months, is because one thing I used to always tell the kids, you know, I would do all I can for you, try to help you, try to be there for you, you know, do all I can with my babies. Don't mess with my babies. And at the time, my youngest son, which is not the one I have now, he's 14, but I had, you know, the one I have, he's 23 now, but he was 5 at that time. We was in the room visiting my mom in Tennessee, and we was in there doing salat, and my youngest son was asleep, and all of a sudden I heard this howl, like, you know, like a child crying, and he walked in, you know, I stayed in my salat, I stayed in my position. He came into the room holding his private part, tears, you know, rinsing down his face, and it was like my heart just dropped. I mean, and they lost me, and I had to come out of Salat. I just couldn't stay in Salat. And I asked him what was wrong, and the young man, of course, he went outside, act like ain't nothing happened, because he had like he ain't nothing doing nothing. He had twisted my child's private part, like literally twisted. And my baby's, when I looked in his little pants, his little private part was red. So I don't know if he kind of twisted off, but all I know is as a mother, my heart was broken, and I just, it took all my strength that I asked Allah to give me to snap. And, you know, Allah was merciful. I didn't snap. Because, you know, really, I thought it was over. I thought it was going to be over for me and that I would have to go to prison. But,
no,
you know,
we can laugh now, sister.
Yeah, Allah was great. You know, everything worked out. So, yeah, to make a story short, he went back into the system. I told him they had to come get him. Okay, when I got back to Tennessee, I mean, got back to Nashville. Well, he was in Nashville. When I got back to Georgia, you know, they took him out of my home, and they put him in a group home. Well, he was 15 at that time. Called me around the age of 17 and told me he was getting ready to go home. And at the time, I was like, okay, because, you know, I'm sitting here like, why is he calling you, first of all? But I'm always nice to people no matter what. I said, oh, okay, well, that's great. He said, but I just wanted to thank you. I was calling to thank you and apologize to you and your family for all the hell that I had put you through. He said, and thank you for not being afraid of the system and giving me the tough love and just teaching me, you know, all the need to be taught in order to survive. He said, because I wouldn't have made it if it wasn't for you. And I said, oh, I said, well, you know, you would have made it. He said, no, he's going to tell me. He said, you know, I was, you know, he said, I had some dark, he said, I was in a dark place. He said, but just watching you and paying attention to y'all as a family and how you raised your kids, and even though you try to raise me to the best you've been, you never forced me, you know, to be Muslim or any of that. He said, but just watching you with your kids and doing all that y'all used to do, he said, you know, I started asking about Islam. You know, and asking more details of how I can, you know, find a masjid and all that. So he ended up asking me, do I know where the masjid he can attend? And I told him, I said, well, I asked what area he lived in at the time. And I said, well, what you can do is check with the area you live in to see if you can find a masjid. So I asked him, I said, also, are you interested in becoming Muslim now? He said, yeah. He said, you know, when I was in your home, he said, for that year, he said, I pay attention to you all and how you raised me. He said, you really did a great job. He said, it's just that I just had my own problems. He said, but I know you did the best you can. I appreciate everything. He said, you know, you was really, you know, a good foster mom. He said, I never had a foster mom who really tried to keep me, you know, in doing the right thing. No matter, you know, even though I did all the things I kept doing, you still stayed there. You know, you gave me that tough love. So, yeah, so he went back home from understanding, you know, where he lived, in, you know, in the project at the time. And I'm assuming that, you know, he did, you know, find a masjid and everything, you know, came out well on that end. But he did change, and how I know that he had changed was that I was told by another foster parent that he was killed. And I said, oh, my God, you know, my heart dropped. I said, what do you mean? She said, yeah. She said, you know, he changed, right? You know, he really turned out okay. He was 18 years of age. Now, take it now, he just called me at 17. And he ended up getting shot in the back by a person who remembered him from his past and said to him, oh, yeah, I remember you. Oh, yeah, yeah, you was this dude and you was that dude, and trying to explain to him the type of person he used to be. And he, from my understanding, they said he was trying to explain to this young man that, you know, he ain't that person anymore. And so he was walking away. They said he was, you know, left the grocery store. He was walking away from the young man, and the young man shot him in the back, and he died. So, you know, I just prayed to Allah, you know, that he found his way, and I think he did. You know, only Allah knows best, but I think he found his way.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for sharing that beautiful story. Tragic, but
yes.
A contribution you made to society. I want to speak about another young man. I had the chance to meet him. We were at a holiday event at your home. And what was so special about him, he was sitting in the sunroom, and he was observing the family and guests in attendance. And truly, I was captivated by this young man being so observant. So I asked him if he was okay, and he responded, "I just love Miss Malika. She has given me a sense of family better than my own family, and I just love her." Malika, this young man, one of his parents tried to take his life.
Correct.
And he survived. Can you talk about this young man for a few minutes?
Yes. What is this young man? I mean, he was, when I say he was very special and unique in his own way, I mean, he was very smart. He was very articulate. But this is what happened with him. He came to my home the first time during respite. Came, you know, I could tell he was different. He was quiet. He kind of stayed off to himself. And so, you know, like I do with all the kids, you know, I try to talk with them, you know, sit down, you know, conversate with him and see how things are going. But I sit down and had a conversation with him, and that's when he was telling me about his, you know, when he was around at the age of nine, how he had died and came back. And he, you know, he came back different. And he noted that he was different and that Allah had blessed him with the gift of color. And what that means is that, okay, he was able to see auras around people and have a sense of their energy. In other words, if a person's energy was just too negative, it really affected him where it just hard for him to stay around with people. His anxiety would kick in and all that would happen. Well, he told me that during his lesson, you know, he was here for, I think, for a weekend. And, well, he, to make a long story short, he came back. And he had disturbed his home that he was in, the same home he came in from respite. And he told me the reason why he disturbed that home is because he wanted to stay with me. And I said, "You did that?" He said, "Yes, ma'am." He said, "But when I came to your home," he said, "I saw this gold aura around you." He said, and I looked, and he said, "Oh, my God." He said, "Person." He said, I'm just new. He said, "Plus, you know, you had talked to me during that time for respite. You sit down and conversate with me." He said, "I really enjoyed being there with you. So I disturbed my home, and they asked me whether I want to go, and he said, I want to go stay with Miss Wali." So anyway, he stayed with me, and he loved it here. He loved it here. We loved him. And he was a good kid. You know, he had his dog days because he was diagnosed with bipolar. But he didn't have a lot of triggers. In other words, you know, every once in a while he'll have an episode, but his episode was never towards me. It was always, you know, just him sitting there at, you know, playing games or something, and, you know, he would get upset. You know, if somebody came into the room, you know, he would tell my son, get the H out of the room. Anyway, I would get on him about it, and he would apologize. And he'd always come back again and things while he, "I'm so sorry. Please don't put me off." I said, "No, sweetie, I would never put you off for that." I said, "You know how many kids I done dealt with and behavior?" I said, "You're doing excellent." I said, "I love you, Sam." And I just explained to him why we had that love for him, because he was a kid that he was doing well in my home. I had him for 5 months. And then the blessing came in for him. And I thank Allah for that. He was able to go home, his father, not his biological father, but the man that was with his mom years before that, he had left due to his mother having the disturbing problems that she had, and told them that any time they needed him, he would be there for them. So what he did, he searched for this young man, found where they were in the system, and, yeah, he brought them, you know, gave them the choice, you know, went through the defects, you know, protocol, making sure he had everything lined up, and they let him go home. So, yeah, so he told me, he thanked me for all I had done, told me that he would never forget me and that he loved my family, and he's just a wonderful young man.
Beautiful. Who is your greatest inspiration, Malika?
Well, I would say, truthfully, Allah is my inspiration, knowing that, you know, I was brought here on this earth to do goodness. My family, my mother, my father, you know, they just pushed me to be strong. And I feel like, you know, this, just being here and caring for people, you know, that's my greatest inspiration, is Allah and my family.
Yes, ma'am. You grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and the role of your parents played an intricate part in your life path. Can you talk about that for a few minutes before we close?
Yes, I would say my mother and my father were loving parents. You know, I just remember, you know, coming up during the times when, you know, you just need to listen and to be respectful. My mother, you know, gave me that tough love, and I think that's where I learned it from. But, you know, she did all she, you know, the best she could do, you know, raising up during that time. And I think I just decided that this was the way to go. And just realized, you know, that, you know, just, you know, trying to be a good parent myself, you know, and learn from how my mother and my grandmother, you know, people who was, you know, strong women in the family, you know, bringing us up, that, you know, yeah, that's my way of just realizing that they did an excellent job, you know, just raising us to be good children. And my mother, you know, she was the stronghold of the family. And, well, you know, just looking over all the years of life and raising my own children and other people's children, you know, that I was taught, you know, that Allah has blessed me with all, you know, mainly just being patient.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. You know, you love children, too.
Yeah, I do. That's the good ones.
Yes, ma'am. And then your children, they're such exceptional young people doing exceptional things in life. Allah has truly blessed you, and it is just wonderful. So my closing remarks are going to be simple, and you are an example of this, Sister Malika, and I thank you for being with us today and sharing with our listening audience your personal story.
You are so welcome, sister. Thank you for having me on the show.
400,000 children needing foster care in the United States. It's not for everyone.
Correct. That's true.
You know, but there are some who can do it, and you are an example of that. So we thank you. And my closing remark, it truly takes a village.
Yes.
And we are so happy and pleased and thankful to Allah that you are a part of this village. Listening audience, this program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent, Murad Speaks. Thank you for joining us today. If you need to reach me, you may do so at Salima, S-A-L-I-M-A-H, M-O-H, 77@gmail.com. Thank you for joining us today. Have a great rest of your day. Assalamu alaikum.